What's going on, everybody? Welcome to On Screen Live's special Toronto International Film Festival episode. My name is Andrew Jupin, and I'm up here right now in the great city of Toronto with another bud of mine. Going to bring him in right now. It's Mr. Chris Cabin.
Hello there. Hi, everybody.
How's it going, dude?
It's going all right. You know, I'm in my zone here. I'm watching movies and doing nothing all day. It's pretty great. that's really where I strive, and that's where I do good. That's where I thrive, rather. But I strive to be in it as much as I can.
Yeah, and so, you know, you're doing what you normally do. You're just in a different country, a different city.
Hey, I mean, I've done it before. I have covered Berlin before, and it is a very good feeling to be like, oh man, I'm an internationalist. Hey, everybody. but you know, it's great. I've never been, I mean, I've been to Toronto many times, but I haven't been to the film festival before.
Right. This is your first TIFF, right? Yeah.
It's been nice to see how organized they are as compared, not to talk shit with New York Film Festival and our very good friend, Jordan Ropp, but much more tidier with the control of the audiences and the critics. Like, it is so much better, like, here, go here, rather than just the great Anaconda line that nearly strangles Juilliard.
Yeah, it's really like a science up here. I actually heard one time that they bring in, there's like consultants that look at spaces and tell you how to utilize them most effectively. Huh. And I mean, you're up here, and yeah, for folks who haven't, you know, attended this festival before, or like a bigger scale film festival, I mean, like, the crowds here are bonkers. And we're not even talking public screenings, we're talking about industry and press screenings. So like, film programmers, buyers, critics, like, there's hundreds of people just walking around this multiplex, and like, the entire day feels like if you're working there, it's like every moment of that day is a busy set on a Saturday night. You know what I mean? Like a movie theater's busiest set is usually like the Saturday early evening show. It's the Saturday early evening show from like 8:30 in the morning till 11 o'clock at night here.
I was listening to a guy talking yesterday who said that he had seen like 35 in one fest. And I was like, I just can't, like, that is, if you're doing that, and like, if you're just sending a report saying, we should buy this or we shouldn't buy this, we should show this or we shouldn't show this, stuff like that, I understand. If you have to write up 35 movies in full, not just like capsules, whatever, you know, capsules are relatively easy, but like, if you have to write up a full fucking bit about 35 fucking movies, that would drive me completely insane. I would
that
not.
That guy, yeah, I mean, that guy has to be a programmer or something.
I would hope.
And he's also staying here like the whole time.
Yes.
We're up here for like 5 days. There's people who do the whole thing. But yeah, you know, I'm seeing in the chat here, you know, welcome back. Missed you guys. We missed you all too. We're also, should say, missing our good bud, Eric Siska. He was supposed to join us on this adventure. And get this, y'all, we're leaving for the airport Wednesday morning. Eric Siska stricken with COVID.
Yes.
So miss you, bud. Hope you're watching. Hope you're fucking feeling better. So we are watching and eating for three.
Yes. That's a good excuse. No, that also will excuse the edibles I've been taking and the amount of carts I've been going through. That would excuse it all. If we're just talking about Eric is here in spirit and taking on a little bit of the load, that it's true. We are missing. We are not holding up our quotient with the beers. I will say we're not doing the work. It's sad.
Yeah. You know, Eric, I did have a couple of really tasty cocktails last night, dude, that you would have enjoyed. But next year, motherfucker. And also, we will be covering the New York Film Festival for On Screen Live. And Eric will be there fresh out of his fucking COVID slumber. So look forward to Eric's thoughts on end of the year movies. But we have some that we want to get to today. Basically, the idea, and it looks like, I mean, I don't want to jinx anything, Chris, but I've been kvetching about the hotel Wi-Fi. Everything seems to be okay. I think we might get through all the movies that we want to talk about.
We can try.
We'll see what we can get through. We only want to do like an hour, because actually, folks, we do have to get back to other screenings, of course.
More to come.
It never ends. But so I think the idea is, these are movies from yesterday and today that we've seen. So that's kind of the schedule here. And also the cool thing is, folks, this festival is massive. And the way that they do the press screenings is not like the way they usually do it in New York, where it's like one at a time for most of the time. This is like 17 things are screening at the same time. So the cool thing is that means there's so many more movies to watch and sift through and research and everything. Chris and I so far have only seen two movies. There's only two movies that Chris and I have both seen.
Yes.
Everything else here, we're going to like go back and forth and give our reviews here. But first up, this is something we saw last night. I believe it is in the midnight. Oh, no, it's a centerpiece here at the festival. It could have, I guess, been in Midnight Madness, but it's not. Some of this guy's other movies could be Midnight Madness for sure.
A Midnight Madness guy for sure. I mean, he straddles the line between that and art house. That is his genius, I would say. But like, yeah, I think you could have put this anywhere, really.
Actually, yeah, yeah. But yeah, so this is the new one from Kiyoshi Kurosawa. It's called Cloud, which is the name of the movie here. And no distributor on this yet. You want to sort of give a quick, like, what is this movie about? Or at least how it starts, like what it's about?
I mean, it is essentially about the life of a reseller in Japan.
So people who like buy... They buy out all the product from one online seller, and then this dude turns it around on his own like selling site and like ups the prices.
He does his own like independent. Like I think a lot of what he's suggesting is that a lot of the other, because he bought, you see the guy buying the stuff from other people a lot, especially in the first half.
Right.
And like it's about like presentation. He has a very particular way he sets it up on his own little site that he has. And you never really get to see what those people tried to do. And I think that's on purpose, that like you don't really see their selling tactic. You only see his selling tactic.
Yeah.
And it's about what happens when his business pisses a few people off and he gets a new weird assistant, I guess, is the main hold of it.
Without like spoiling too much of it. Yeah. This movie, I you know, when we spoke last night coming out of the theater and walking back to the hotel, I wasn't as high on it as I think I am now. I sort of let it like marinate for a little while. And sometimes that's what you got to do, gang. Like you just got to let these things sit with you for a little bit. But, you know, Chris, one of the things that I was complaining about was that it's 2 hours and 3 minutes. And your point back to me was like, well, he's using a lot of that build up time to sort of lull you into a certain kind of not emotional state, but what were you saying?
Like, it's because essentially he's a reseller, and the whole point is like he has a very nice life as a reseller. He doesn't really have to do any work. His work is buying things, bring them to his house, and then making some posts on the internet, which is not real work, really. I mean, there's a lot.
Look what we're doing right now.
I mean, hey, look, it is. I think that's also part of his point, is that it is a huge part of the economy now, is work like that. But it's not real work. And like, it is very easy to become accepting of that and to get comfortable doing that and not really think about things other than continuously making, you know, shipping the product and making money. And that's all he's thinking about at the, in the beginning of the movie. And you're supposed to be okay with it, I think, for at least the first hour or so. And then the things start happening. I liked, not to give anything away, but I like Josh Lewis, a friend of the show, was like, I didn't know Kurosawa could make a Reservoir Dogs. And like,
yeah, that's that kind of what it ultimately winds up being.
It is a weird way he gets there. And I do think, to what you were saying, like, because also I would understand the length thing, because the last movie we saw by Kurosawa was a like 45 minute movie released only online, I think.
Chime,
which is great, a really, really good movie that you should go and seek out. If you can, but that was a movie that felt very much akin to his early days, like Cure, Pulse, the big stuff that really made his career.
It's very more horror.
Very, very immediately recognizable as what it is, I guess, is a way to say it.
Right.
This, and I hear his French remake of his own movie, Serpent's Path, feel different. They're very different. They're more. There's an action element to it that isn't really in his other movies. He doesn't like action usually. Usually what is eerie about his movies is the inaction and like the staying on things and the eeriness of just like kind of getting used to something and then noticing something weird in the background. Is a tactic he will use a lot. Now it's not like that with this. It's much more active. The camera is way more alert and aggressive, I would say. I think it's one of his better ones in a while. I'm a really big fan of Creepy, which was I actually saw at Berlin. I think that was 2016. I think this one also has a lot to do with his relationship with I don't know if you've been reading the interviews he's been doing about his relationship with Hamaguchi. Was his protege. Like he taught him. And I think
Ryusuke Hamaguchi from Drive My Car.
The big man. Big man in Japanese cinema right now. He's the biggest guy there is. Evil does not exist of this year.
Right.
What
was the Wheel of Fortune and
Wheel of Fortune and Fantasy, which
and fantasy, yes.
His girlfriend in this movie is from the first section of that movie. The woman at in the center of that one.
Got it. All right.
But I do think it's and there's also some one or two other Hamaguchi regulars that do show up in the cast, especially in the second half. And I think it is. I think it's a lot about how Hamaguchi, like talking about his influence and all that, kind of gave him a second life. Like broken him out from being like a just getting used to his own style, because that's what he's lulling himself like in the beginning. He's lulling himself. I'm doing the same thing over and over again. It's mostly working. It's sometimes it does not. And I think that's what he's talking about. Is like it gave him a jolt to be have this relationship with him, but this relationship is also there's something weird about it, and there's something intimate about it that you can't really talk about with anybody but that person. And I think that would lead to the very creepy ending for people who get to see it. I hope somebody picks it up. I really do. I think it's a really good movie.
Yeah, you know, that's what I was going to sort of close out on for this one. Yeah, no distribution yet. It's kind of interesting. I could see, like, there's so many companies now where I could see this going. Like, I think this would be a good movie. But, I mean, their slate is jammed. They've been buying a lot.
You know, I haven't heard them, and I know it's a weird because we were talking about the Midnight Madness thing. It would be weird, but I could see Shudder doing something with this. I could imagine them being able to put a polish on this, because it's not exactly horror, but it does have these elements that they like, and that their genre pickings are very similar to this.
They do have, especially just thinking on like Asian cinema, there's a lot of just crime movies on Shudder when you sort of pick through that stuff, and this does play like a thriller in parts. And then there's a big action sequence at the end, which Josh is right, like if you put Stuck in the Middle with You on there, it's just there's a lot of shooting afoot, so we'll see about that. But the next movie, speaking of movie, it does have distribution, and it's Mubi. But this one was one that you saw, Chris. I'll be seeing it at the New York Film Festival. The new one from Mahdi Diop, though, Dahomey.
Oh, hell yeah. It's amazing. I'm so sad that my wife has to be a teacher, goddammit. Because this is stuff. She was a museum educator for quite a while before she became a teacher. Uh-huh. And this stuff, this movie is talking about stuff she's been yammering in my ear about for years now. And it's about the central idea is, I think it was, I want to say it was like 2021, maybe. France decided to return 26 pieces to Benin, which was known as the Kingdom of Dahomey beforehand.
Okay.
And it's essentially about the transportation and like the discussion around the returning of those 26 pieces, because it was 26 out of the number they quote in the movie is 7,000.
Fuck.
And if you know anything about museums or read anything, I'm sure as of recent, there have been a lot of articles about this stuff, about how like the V&A is a horrible perpetrator with this thing. They just have stuff that they should be returning. Like the
Victoria and Albert Museum in London.
Yeah, Victoria and they had a lot of the people who run their PR have not been sleeping well. I'll say it that way. there's been some statements that have not been great about this stuff.
But sure. This
takes a completely, as I would expect from the director of Atlantics, this takes a completely original look at it. not only does she use, there's like a voice of the artwork that comes in and out throughout the movie. Uh-huh. This weird, like, guttural sounding voice that adds this mystical element to it that is very, very needed, I think. But also, she spends a lot of time with, there's there was a discussion, an open forum, really, for people when the artworks came home, discussing what it means that they were being returned. Is it a slap in the face, or is it like hope inducing? Is it really the triumph of Macron because he gets to look like he's being very liberal and nice to people?
What a favor I'm doing. Here's seven, you know, whatever, not many pieces back.
Not the greatest of guys. So, like, you wonder if it is just a PR move, but or is it a PR move for the president of Benin? Like, that's something they also discuss. And it's in that discussion and cutting that between, like, the first exhibitions of the work and people coming in and all these, like, unbelievable, like, wardrobes, these traditional, like, wraps and all this stuff that are really incredible and are also, like, symbols of their culture, right? And, like, things that have stretched overseas. It's become a globalist, like, it is about globalism in its way, because it is about, what does it mean that this thing is no longer just yours? Can it be yours again? Is that possible under what we currently have? I think it suggests a lot of this. It does all this in 67 minutes, which is a dream to me.
Dude, what a runtime, man. Look at, just God bless you.
Yeah, I love this. For personal reasons, I really sunk into it, but I think anybody would really enjoy this.
That's, and if you haven't seen Atlantics, one of her previous films, primo stuff there.
Still on Netflix? I'm pretty sure.
It's around somewhere. If not, you'll be able to find it. Okay, now volley over to me. I caught something yesterday that I've been very much looking forward to. It won the grand prize. It was nominated for Palme d'Or, didn't get it, but it won the grand prize at Cannes this year. It's a film called All We Imagine as Light by Payal Kapadia. This is out at some point. I would guess they might try to do this for the end of the year from Sideshow and Janus Films, maybe early next year. Basic gist of the story is it follows two women in Mumbai who are working as nurses, and the younger girl has to move in with the older girl. So they're roommates, and they lead two completely different lives. The older woman is already in an arranged marriage, and her husband lives in Germany, like, full time. And has been over there for years. And it's one of those, like, yeah, I used to hear from him. And now that, you know, communication is less and less and less and less. And, like, that's her existence. Meanwhile, like, there's a doctor at the hospital that's totally into her. And, you know, so that's her thing. And then the other woman is really not about that traditional living, does not want to have an arranged marriage, and in fact has, like, a little got a fella on the side. And so it's like the tensions that kind of come out of that, as and also, like, the tensions of living in a society with that kind of expectation. This is Payal Kapadia's follow-up to A Night of Knowing Nothing, which was
really good. Really worth the, I think last time I saw it was on Criterion Channel, if you want to check. But really, really worth checking out if you haven't.
It's a beautiful film, but it's also, like, nonfiction. And this is a fiction film. But it is just absolutely gorgeous. I was trying to find, I think in the copy they might mention the cinematographer. No, I think I maybe read that someplace else. I don't have it in front of me, but it's a gorgeous movie, and it has this really, like, breezy's the wrong word, but it just has this really watchable indie movie vibe to it, complete with, like, third act brief road trip kind of thing, like, you know, that sort of road trip, but, like, a very purposeful change of location at the end of the movie. We're going to go from where we've been the whole movie to this other place, and revelations happen here. It's absolutely stunning, I have to say. It's a beautiful movie, and I've talked about this on the air a lot. I know, Chris, you've heard me yammering for years about it. back in 2004, and I've been doing this for 20 years, when I was watching the film Before Sunset in theaters, it got to what turned out to be the last shot of the movie, and I didn't know it at the time, but in my head I was like, wow, that's a great last shot. Please, and in my head I said, like, please, Linklater, let that be the last shot of your movie. And it was. Yeah. And that sort of set me off on this when I'm watching movies. Now, sometimes if I feel the movie's coming to an end and there's a really great shot, I'm like, ooh, kill it there. Kill the lights. Come on, do it. This movie fucking has that. And it is just a gorgeous, gorgeous shot. It's a fucking shot that, like, you want to frame and put on your wall, and people would be like, who took that photograph? And you can say it was from this amazing movie. I'm so glad that, and I didn't know going into it that it had distribution, and up comes the Sideshow and Janus logo, and I was like, it's in good hands.
I think they know how to handle movies like this. And I we were talking last night about it. It is so, because it looks, just the stills even looks so colorful and so, like, beautifully shaded, as compared to A Night of Knowing Nothing is all black and white. And it's all, like, really grainy footage. Yeah. It's a completely different aesthetic from the looks of it. Yep. It's just a kind of amazing to have that much personality in two hits, and not have to, like, excuse yourself, not to have to do anything, to be like, now I'm doing this instead, just to do it and not excuse it.
Nope, it all just totally works. And the other thing I'll point out is so much of it, I mean, she does a really great job at giving it also this very neo-realist feel. There's so much time spent on, like, just photographing streets of Mumbai and people, and it just, Mumbai is such a character on screen in the film too. So you have this, you know, on the one hand, these, like, very indie sort of sensibilities from a storytelling standpoint, but then from a filmmaking standpoint, just, you know, whiffs of neorealism going on. So it's just, it's a really, really special movie, and, you know, keep your eyes peeled. It will be, you know, available at art houses and, you know, on the Criterion Channel at some point.
I think it's also at New York Film Festival too.
I think you're right.
If so, I will be seeing it, and I can't wait to see it.
Big recommend. All right, back to you, my friend. You saw something just yesterday. This is The Seed of the Sacred Fig.
Yes, Mohammad Rasoulof. Apologies if I have the name wrong. I think I listened to it twice to figure this out, because I do really love this guy. He recently had to flee from Iran not too long ago. He's been making some really, his big focus has been the death penalty in Iran.
Okay.
He made a movie that was essentially three vignettes about the death penalty. Was one of his more recent ones called There Is No Evil. It was very good. It had distribution. I forget who had it. I think you can, it shows up on Criterion occasionally. This was a jury. I think this got a special jury prize at Cannes.
Okay.
It is a huge leap in terms of his style, his confidence as a filmmaker. It's just such a humongous leap into something that's much bigger, much weirder, but has still his concerns are baked into it. It's about essentially an investigator judge in Iran who is essentially he has a name like that, but what he goes to work to do every day is to essentially have to rubber stamp death penalties. And he is occasionally asked to actually investigate, but because they have so many in the country, he's being demanded to get through it, because we have 300 more coming in.
We got all these people to kill. Stamp those fucking things.
And it's about essentially his decline and his family's decline from the after effects of that, as well as the recent protests, I'm sure everybody knows, with hijab protests in Iran, women take them off and burning them. That has a lot to do with what happens as far as the deterioration goes.
You say the decline of the family, like, it's like the toll it takes on him and then trickles down to the family, like, well, the toll of the job.
it's interesting. I mean, that's what's interesting about the structure is that it starts very much with him for about 30 minutes to 40 minutes. And then it's just the his wife and his daughters for a good hour before his story kind of comes back in. You see him, he comes in, and like the connections are very well threaded throughout it of what's going to, like, you can see what's going to come together, but you don't see how. And what it does, he takes such a huge leap, especially in the last like 20 minutes. And I've seen people somewhat not okay with this. I think it's great. I think he should. I'm all about push the buttons, see if you can try something new. if it gets weird emotions, that's whatever. You know, you can, next time you'll be able to hone it. That's not a big deal.
Better than no reaction at all.
Exactly. And like, whereas I do really like A Man of Integrity, which is very good, and There Is No Evil. This one I love. Like, I could see this winning a bunch. It has some of the most, we were just talking about images, it has some of the most striking images of his career by and his most interesting uses. He's very his palette is usually very dull. It's very browns, grays, whites, blacks, beiges, stuff like that. There's a lot more like what Wenders would do with neon light, he does with other kinds of light in these very tricky and interesting ways that really do highlight how far he wants to go with it. The last shot is also incredible in this one, but he does a smart thing and does a Spike Lee, and he has a lot of footage of actual protests after the last image.
So like end of Black Klansman kind of.
There's a lot throughout. He uses quite a lot of I think to the movie's benefit, uses a lot of actual footage from YouTube, TikTok of these protests, what's been happening. Also the retaliation. There's a lot of police brutality in it that is not so easy to watch. But it's very long.
That's fucking street justice death penalty, dude. That's boots on the ground death penalty out there.
Neon has this.
Yep.
And this will be probably a big one for the foreign Oscar. I would imagine. I have such a hard time imagining this doesn't get attention, and especially after the reaction at Cannes was so strong. But who knows? You never know with this stuff. But I think you should see it as soon as you possibly can. Even if you're in Toronto right now, you should absolutely try to find a ticket to this thing.
Yeah, seriously. Let me look up. For anyone in Toronto right now, you got public screenings coming up on the 11th and the 12th. Man, 9 p.m. and 8:45 p.m. That's cruel considering it's a 2 hour and 47 minute runtime.
Yeah, that's
good.
It's not going to send you off to sleep easily either. It's not one of those movies where you're like, oh, good, I can go to bed now. No, right, you're going to have a couple ideas that are going to be kicking around there for a little bit.
So complete shift in direction now. Film I caught with our buds Josh and Jamie from the Sleazoids podcast yesterday morning. I, the Executioner is the name of the motion picture here, directed by Ryu Seung-Wan. This movie is a sequel. So I went in kind of not knowing what was going on. I'm trying to see the name of the movie is Veteran. Yes. From 2015. So, you know, 9 years later you have the sequel. So basically it is a, I don't know if you could tell from the still here, this is a kick ass fight that people are having in the rain right here. But this is not an art movie at all. I mean, it's art in its own way, but it's not an art house movie. This is a fucking action crime kind of comedy. It dances on the edge of a knife with, like, yeah, it's about a pretty brutal serial killer. But then also it's very funny throughout, like the opening sequence. And I guess the original is also like this, or the first film, I should say. It's about this team of cops. Here's this team. The opening sequence is them like busting an illegal gambling parlor, and it is just gold. It's gold, Jerry. Like, you know, the laughs at like action sequences that involve vicious punches to the nuts, that kind of stuff. You know what I mean? And so. So think of that, like all that shit's going on, right? I don't remember the tune, but like as this gambling hall is clearing out, these people are fleeing and cops are arresting all these people and everything. There's some like crooner tune playing and it is just fucking hilarious. So like, that's how it starts. And then it goes into this, like the main part of the story is there is a serial killer out there who's basically, he's had it up to here with the Korean authorities about like letting criminals off or not getting harsh enough sentences. So this guy's kind of like taking shit into his own hands. And what he's doing is finding people who are let out or got off on like murders and doing those murders to those perpetrators. All right. So like there's a dude who fucking killed someone and like burned them with cigarette butts all over. This serial killer goes and finds the guy and does that to him. Like it's that kind of thing. So the cops are trying to find this guy and it kind of just goes from there. It was kind of funny because Josh wrote on Letterboxd that he thought it was like the most easily identifiable twist in a movie. And I would just argue it's so there that I don't think they try to have a twist. There's just a turn in the movie where it lets you in on who the killer is. Mm-hmm. So that like the mystery of it goes away, which I think is fine. It adds to the cat and mouse nature of it. But man, that was a 2 hours that flew right by. I don't know that I'd seen any other Ryu Sung-won films. Like I haven't seen Smugglers, I haven't seen Veteran. So like this was a completely new director for me. And I was blown away. Like the filmmaking is so active, the camera is doing so much fun stuff, it looks good. I mean, like it's just pure entertainment. And yeah, on top of it's a really grim serial killer movie. So well, like a content of seven sort of, but much lighter and airy at times.
I mean, there's serial killer movies recently, because you saying this, it reminds me a lot of I would butcher his name because I didn't look it up. Johnny Toll's old writer and directing partner made a movie, I think it's like 2 years ago now, called Detective versus Sleuths. That is very similar to that, but it's about like a detective versus the gang of people trying to do the revenge kind of thing.
I mean,
as far as the serial killer, every time a serial killer movie came out like in the last 10 years, I've been like really, really skeptical. And recently I've been like, I could take a few more. If you got more for me, I will start watching these again now. So I'm happy to hear. I want to watch Veteran now just to have it in my head whenever this comes out.
Exactly. And I asked Josh like afterwards, I was like, I followed that movie, so I don't think it was too beholden to info from the first one. And he said, no, they kind of reference the case from the first movie at one point, but otherwise, like I was able to watch this totally fine. Good. But yeah, no distribution. This is something that I could see going to Wellgo USA. Wellgo's awesome because they do such a great job on bringing in a lot of Asian genre stuff.
Oh man.
So like Wellgo or Variance Films, Variance, amazing dudes over there at Variance. Like Variance is who brought RRR here and did all those bookings and everything. So like I could see it going to one of those two places. And I think their buyers definitely need to look into it if they're not already.
I would assume like Wellgo USA had they've just had a huge triumph. Twilight of the Gods Walled In, which is so fucking good.
Oh, I got to see it.
It's really, really worth Soi Chang, who is just one of the best directors to come out of Hong Kong in so long. But I would love to see them take something like this. It sounds like exactly the kind of thing they do pick up. So I wouldn't be surprised.
Exactly. You know, and barring that, like maybe it's a thing where the New York equivalent is like it gets one screen at the Empire, you know, 25 in Times Square.
Mm-hmm.
That's just where the audience goes. Sure. Like they do that a lot with like South Asian cinema. So we'll see. But man, oh man, folks, if the Executioner is anywhere around you, definitely give it a pass and check it out. So we're going to go into another one that is I will be catching at the New York Film Festival. But Chris, this is the new one from Jia Zhangke.
Oh, boy.
Caught by the Tides is the name of the motion picture. And yes, folks, once again, great taste at the buyer's market for Sideshow and Janus Films. This is them also.
Yeah, I think they've been working on some restorations of some early stuff. And I think this is probably just like in line with that. They probably want to be able to put out a couple of his. I heard, I don't know if this is true, I heard they're working on an Unknown Pleasures restoration, which would be fantastic since
cool.
All, like early aughts, like digital work, it just gets blown out all the time.
If they're doing a bunch of those restorations, I wonder if they might be getting a like a Jie Zhangqi equivalent of their like World of Wong Kar Wai traveling thing that they did.
That would be great. I would buy the shit out of that. If they did, if they put Platform out on Blu-ray, I'm gonna have to have it. You know, this is if anybody's been following his work, this is very much in line with what he's been doing lately. The last movie was Swimming Out to the Sea Turns Blue, which was all about writers from China and like ones that he personally had some camaraderie with and like felt something about their writing that inspired him. So it's weird. We haven't actually had a fiction from or a narrative feature from him since 2018, which is was Ashes Pure as White, which is phenomenal.
Oh Jesus, it's been it's that long?
Been a very long time. And
I'm sitting here like, I remember that movie.
Yes, it's been a while. And like, that was and Swimming Out Till the Sea Turns Blue was 2020, so nobody remembers it. It was in the nothing year.
Yes.
So this what's interesting about this movie, and it's true of a lot of his movies. It feels like he's revisiting things in a new light. Like he's bringing back ideas he had, characters he had, even like this. There's like footage from this that feels repurposed from all parts of his career. I swear, parts of it were from still life. Parts of it felt like they were from like very early stuff. And he's using it to create a new narrative. And what's interesting is there isn't really it's a hard movie to really describe because it is this almost musical thing. Like it's a lot of dancing, like shots of people dancing and like people in clubs where music is going. Zhao Tao is there, his partner and creative. She's been in all of his movies. She is there and she's front and center. And the last like 20 to 30 minutes, it settles into a kind of narrative space. Uh-huh. But until then, it is a lot of weird decision, a lot of weird camera angles. He's just like trying stuff out. It felt my first thought was Godard because he just died. So maybe that had some effect on him. I don't know. But that was the first thought I had is because it is very more, I think somebody likened to cubism almost. I think it was Will Sloan, the great Will Sloan.
Sure.
And that is it. Like there's this weirdness to the first hour and 20 minutes or so of this movie that you can't really pin what he's doing, but he does seem to be plucking from old movie, like footage he didn't use from old movies and repurposing him into this story of this character, like wandering through China in the time of like past, present, everything collapsing in on itself.
Okay.
And he makes that like, whereas his other movies have been much more crime centered. There's a narrative pull to it. This feels a lot more chaotic. And I think that's a reflection of what his country is going through right now.
Sure.
It affected me. At first, I didn't know what he was doing. And then eventually I was like, well, I see a pattern here. And then when he settles in at the end, you kind of see exactly what he was trying to say at the whole time, which is true of a good amount of his movies, actually.
I feel like every time I watch a film of his, like I'm sitting there for at least 30 minutes, like, gosh, what's going on during this movie? And then like eventually like a key turns and you're like, oh, you know what I mean? Like you do have this moment of like, oh, it's all coming together and now this makes perfect sense. I definitely had that with what was the triptych that he did?
Is that are you thinking of A Touch of Sin?
Yes, I believe so. I remember specifically being like at the Walter Reed for the New York Film Festival and like 40 minutes into the movie was like, you know, and like, it's cool when that happens. You realize like, oh shit, now I'm like geared in, you know, now it's making sense.
Well, I mean, it makes sense that like in the decade, like A Touch of Sin was a big movie for him. It got him a lot more attention than he, and then.
I think it was, that was probably, would you say that was probably his the movie of his to make the biggest splash in America?
In America, possibly. I mean, the his early stuff did have like a real, like Hoberman was really championing him. A lot of like big critics were really going for him in the early days. But Touch of Sin, Into the Mountains May Depart, Into Ashes Purest White do seem like the ones that had the most attention. Yes, indeed, from Important Sympathy. He's a great critic, a great guy.
Will Sloan that we're talking about. Yeah. We had our good buddy Sucked points out Will Sloan from Important Sympathy.
Thank you, Suck. and I do think like after you make three movies like that, to me are like nearly perfect, if not, like you do kind of want to play around. You're like, well, I've done this well, so now I'm gonna try a doc. I'm gonna try this weird collagist thing I'm doing here. It's something. It's worth it. If you really love him and you love what he's been doing, I think you'll get a lot out of it. I do not think it's the best for a first timer. I think you would be a little lost if this was your first time into his world, but definitely worth it for the heads out there.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. Janice Sideshow Films again. Okay. Now again, man, get ready for a gear shift like you've never experienced from that to The Substance. That's right. The Substance, y'all. The new one from Coralie Farja, who, if you have not seen, speaking of Shudder, it's on there. It was a Shudder original, I believe. Her previous film, Revenge.
Fun movie.
Oh my God. Like the last, I mean, I dug that movie when it came out. I caught the last like 15, 20 on a rando like Shudder TV night. And was just reminded all over again about how great that movie is. And I am happy to report that this film, The Substance, boy, she's two for two. We'll say full disclosure, this is not something I saw on ground here at TIFF. I caught it about a week and a half ago in New York, but it's part of the festival, so I did want to mention it. But basically, this is the movie you may have heard rumblings about already, because it played Cannes already. Demi Moore, wow, is she's back in a big way in this movie. It's her and Margaret Qualley are the two characters, and basically the gist of the movie is Demi plays a Jane Fonda-esque aerobics kind of person who was like super big in the 80s and now like is aging out of that field, air quotes for the people listening to the podcast there.
Yeah.
Around aging out. And so she is going to be let go by her shithead network boss, played by in a best that he's been in, I don't even know how long, Dennis Quaid.
DQ.
Because we were talking on the air, I think in an upcoming season 15 episode that we just recorded.
Talk with Jay about Reagan, which is an atrocity. And but he's to be fair, I give him some shit in that about that movie. He is very good in the Soderbergh High and Low remake.
Oh, the TV show, yes,
Full Circle, I think it's called,
or the
Full
Circle?
Something.
Full Circle's in it. Yeah. It's Alex Winter is in that movie. Love that guy.
Yeah, yeah.
He's wearing the absolute best suit I've ever seen in my life on that show. But so yeah, Quaid as the scumbag network executive guy, real piece of shit. Performance seems to come real easy to him.
From inside, from the heart.
Yeah. So basically, here we go into the body horror portion of the show. Basically, Demi finds, she gets a secret, mysterious message. Hey, if you do this, medical thing, use the substance, another one of you, younger and whatever, will come into existence. Can you tell how much I'm struggling not to spoil stuff? Because, I mean, it is...
It's fine.
It is one of those movies, folks. I tell you right now, like, just don't read anything about it. Don't read a plot description. Don't read film festival copy. Just know that, like, it is a body horror film par excellence, with amazing practical effects, some real scuzz feeling Los Angeles vibes, and just these two great performances in Demi and Margaret Qualley. I was really, my mouth was open a lot of the time, just like, wow, they're really doing this, huh? Mm-hmm. And then like 20 minutes goes by and you're like, whoa, they're really doing that. And then the movie reaches its conclusion and you're like, well, holy shit, that was a movie. I mean, it is the wildest movie I've seen this year. I think it will be, you know, it will be in my best of list in some way. Okay. It's, I'll tell you right now, for the squeamish, y'all better go see something else. Because it gets gross, friends. Oh, does it get gross. It gets so gross that you're like disgusted, and then it keeps going, and it keeps going to the point where it then just becomes funny. And it just, I mean, it just works, and she pulls it off magnificently. Coralie does. And I mean, just my fucking hat is off to her. She made possibly the best horror movie of the year. It's really fucking good. And man, these guys expanding their portfolio. MUBI has this. This is a MUBI release. How fucking cool. Like, listen, if you had to say a distributor you want to go work for right now, I would say it's either MUBI or it's Neon. And that's my story, and I'm sticking to it. But The Substance just, and also, like, it's saying something. Like the best of any genre cinema. Yes, it's filled with gross out gags, practical effects, nudity, what, you know, this, that, and the other thing. Sure. But it's also saying something in a big, bold way. So it's probably one of my biggest recommends out of the festival.
Nice. I'm very much looking forward to it. I missed the screenings before we left, and I don't know if we're talking about the end next, but I saw the end rather than going on. Josh Lewis had, well, I saw Caught by the Tides with him this morning. He was going off to The Substance, which was packed. This P and I was fucking slammed, and I went off to the end, which was also slammed.
They did the midnight. It was actually funny. I was sitting here in the hotel room, and they were doing the Midnight Madness screening.
Yeah,
and I'm sitting here like looking at the clock, and I'm like,
you're getting now.
There's hundreds of people that are totally grossed out and having an awesome time right now. And just, you know, I will put it out there too, like Demi and Margot Qualley, like these are some, I don't know, I probably already said it, but these are some performances, and these women really, really go for it. So the end is not next, Chris, but talk about a gear shift once again.
Well, sure. Nothing
follows up a discussion of The Substance with your review of the new Hong Sang-soo film.
Perhaps the most genteel filmmaker that has ever been. Like,
yeah. I don't know what this dude's idea of a body horror movie would be, and I don't know that I want to find out.
I don't know if he could do horror. That just doesn't sound like his thing.
No.
I mean, there are definitely feelings like awkwardness horror that he has plumbed before. Certain dinner table scenes where you're like, oh my God, oh God, please stop. And like, it's not going to stop. I'll make it quick with this, because anybody, you're either a Song Soup person or you're not. It's a very easy thing. I would suggest everybody try. I would not start with his last, like, because the guy puts out fucking movies. His last, like, eight have been, like, these weird experiments into, like, how crappy, like, quote-unquote crappy can the image get. He's using it for more experimental ideas, which I really do like. I like that he's doing it. I like that Soderbergh's doing it. I think that's a very much... in his way, because, and he has talked about it, why he does that is because you can get a movie made in 10 days with these little cameras and these fucking shitty old ones. You don't have to, and with the setups he does, it doesn't take too long. It's usually one static shot of one thing. So this one is about a theater teacher and an old actor director who comes back, her uncle, the theater teacher's uncle. And their relationship, he starts a romance with her old professor, they are both working with a group of girls for a short play for a festival that they're going to do. There is all other means, as anybody who knows anything about Sing Soo, there are all little pockets of drama along that way that he plums. There's the old director, the old writer of it, was sleeping with all the girls, so therefore he's not there, but he comes back a couple times. It's hard not to say, like, Romare and Allen are really the two things you have to think of with him, even now, even with the polish, like, gone, it's still those kinds of movies.
Right.
I love them. I remember I was thinking very much of Vince Vaughn's recent comments about adult movies and like how you don't really get movies about what just people go through on a day-to-day basis anymore. And like right. these movies are super, super, super about those things.
Yeah.
So I really liked this one. I've also liked, I don't think it's here, but it will be at New York Film Festival, Traveler's Needs, which is his second one this year. He has done three in a year before. He has, the motherfucker yeah. doesn't do that.
It's crazy.
He's crazy. It's insane. It's insane that he has this kind of output, but I was really taken by it. It's a really sweet movie. It's actually a lot more sweet nature than his movies usually are. There's usually a little bit more darkness to them. This one was very, everything was very positive. There's something in the back where you can kind of feel like there, he probably had a chance to bring something darker in, but he didn't. But that's, he's done it before. So I don't mind him doing it, be a little more sweeter on this one. Hey, you know what, Cinema Guild, thank you for keep on putting out these guys' movies, because
yep.
it's been fun. It really yeah. has been.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. Like, I find his movies totally charming. I mean, but when I tell you the amount of times I've seen these three exact yeah. people sit around a table and fucking talk about something while drinking mm-hmm. soju and eating good food and then just quietly going for a walk. I mean, you know, what you say about like, oh, yeah, you know, with this tiny equipment, you know, the setups are really quick and blah, blah, blah. And it's true. And you can get things made, but the scope with which you can work is very limited.
Very small. Very
small. And it's, you know, I don't want to generalize his filmography because, like, the dude's under 60. He's made, like, fucking 50 movies or something.
Yeah.
Like that. It's an insane number of movies. But when I'm there, I'm like, yeah, okay. He's a director where it's like, if it's on and I'm sure. staying for something after it,
yeah.
I'll check it out. Someone points out in the chat, just want to let's see, oops, wrong button, there we go. Let's see here. Designiana says it took a couple films for them to fully get on board with Hong Sang-soo, but The Woman Who Ran
really good one
did it. That's a good movie.
One of his best of the recent vintage. I mean, it's really been like the last six where he's been going into this like In Water, which is all out of focus.
Yeah, thanks, man. I'll catch you on the next one with that director. I mean, Hong.
It's good for a movie that's out of focus the whole time. It's really fucking good. And
of
like,
course it is, because like it's still him. It's not like me doing it.
No, sure. I it's ridiculous. But like you don't see too many guys who are really playing with the form anymore. And like him and Soderbergh are the two that are the most prominent and who get, you know, picked up still, who get distributed still.
Yep.
So I kind of, even when I'm less, there have been a few that I've been, I just love the fact that, again, it's the Vaughn thing where I'm like, I just like that this is a movie about people talking about things that they've held back or not held back. Like things
yeah.
that are very simple like that. I have a kinship with, but yeah, it's not for everyone. But I would say The Woman Who Ran is a good place to start. It's a really good one.
Yep. Totally agree. All right. I keep motoring through here because we don't want to go too much past the hour, especially you have a screening before I do, I think. It might be the other way around. Anyway, yeah. So here we go. One that I caught just this morning, The Luckiest Man in America. This is from director Samir Oliveros. No distribution just yet, but this movie is, you see him right here. I can get him off the
screen. My guy.
Paul Walter Hauser, of course, from Richard Jewell and a thousand other appearances and things.
Excuse me, Cruella. You're not.
Oh, right. One of the feisty dog catchers in Cruella. Yes, how could I please. Forget? No, so he is he's playing a dude, Michael Larson. This is based on a true story. Michael Larson was a guy who appeared on the American game show Press Your Luck. And was able to game the game. Mm. And it's like him taping this thing. Walton Goggins is playing the host of the game show.
Nice.
The woman who pops up in bits on I Think You Should Leave. Patty Harrison.
Patty
great. Is on the panel. And there's another dude who I don't know. And they're like the three contestants. And so basically it's like you're trapped in this TV studio, because the whole thing was like he was able to game it so that he kept being able to play, and no one else would get a turn. And so he just kept running up the scoreboard. Like, he made over like $100,000 off of, he basically was tricking the game in a way. I don't want to give too much away, but so you're stuck in the studio with like the producer played by David Strathairn. He's got like a network person at CBS breathing down his neck about what's going on. This guy's costing us all this money. Don't you vet these people? It's that kind of a thing. It's kind of just a not good quiz show. If you want to, it's not bad outright.
Sure.
I think the filmmaking is just really boring. I mean, when you're stuck in a tiny TV studio, you either have to do your best to make the movie not feel like that or lean into the claustrophobia. And this just kind of falls in the middle, and the filmmaking doesn't do anything to boost those vibes at all. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Paul Walter Hauser's doing his thing. David Strathairn's saying fuck up and down the block, which is great.
Nice.
Shamir Anderson has a supporting role as like Strathairn's second in command, and that dude fucking kicks ass. He's kind of the best part of the movie. But yeah, I don't know that I can recommend it, because the whole time, you know, I was thinking to our brother in pod, Steve Sadak, who loves Quiz Show, one of his favorite movies, and I was
one of my favorites.
Steve would be so mad right now. Okay. He would be so mad, because it's like poor Quiz Show. You know, so like, if you're on a plane maybe and this has found distribution, sure, it's quick, it's 90 some odd minutes, but overall did not really vibe for me. But he does look fantastic playing this Michael Larson character, except it's a bad wig, and you can tell pretty easily. All right, Chris, you mentioned this earlier, but this is the narrative feature debut from Joshua Oppenheimer, the known documentarian. This is The End.
Yes. Man, oh man, this is a lot of movie. This is 2.5 hours of a movie, and like,
that's a big boy.
It's a big premise, so I kind of give it a long leash on those. Like, it's about a family, an oil tycoon magnate's family has been, after the apocalypse, has been living on in a like very extravagant bunker they've built in a salt mine that he has purchased at some point. They don't really get into how he got the salt mine, and then one day somebody shows up, and it's about how they react to that, what happens with that. It's got an incredible cast. It is really, really, it's a good movie. I can't say I loved it. It's a little too polished. What it's trying is a little too, I do think, is a little too metaphorical in certain ways. And like, there's a lot of trickery going on with like, some, it looks like people die, but then they don't. And like, there's a lot of stuff there where I'm like, it doesn't quite hold together as I want it to, but for something this big and this ambitious, I kind of give it. The thing I haven't been saying is it's a musical.
Don't bury the lead there. Yeah. Song and dance abound.
Yes. More song than dance, but there is some dancing. And it's really, there are some images that are really strong. It's emotionally doesn't work for me. It's one of those movies where you can't really see the actual ending of things, but you can see the trajectory. You know where we're heading to. You know where we're getting off, at least. And to that, like, that always bums me out a little bit when I can call it a little, not like call it like I got it. It's just like, I'm like, I kind of know where we're going, and it brings me there anyway. And I can't really, but then again, I can't really argue with, because the performances are insane. Tilda Swinton is amazing in this, and I think a lot of people have forgotten how good she can be. She is fucking insane in this movie.
Nice.
George MacKay from The Beast, who is also great. Michael Shannon is the oil magnate. He's very, very good in it.
Is he singing? Does he sing a song?
He does. He does sing quite a bit.
I'm so tickled already. I can't wait.
It's all mostly those three. Lenny James shows up, but he barely sings. Moses Ingram is in the cast. She sings.
She's good.
She's great. It's the story just kind of goes, never quite goes into the darker places you want. But the thing I do have to give it is that he is he's dealing with the same ideas that he was dealing with in The Act of Killing as far as memory goes and how we create narrative as a way to, and I think in this movie, we create musicals in the wake of like not dealing with real painful personal tragedies or things that we have done, guilt. I think that that is baked into the story. That is a part of it. So I kind of see the connection, and I see why it's very much about whiteness and how that, how narratives have fueled that. So again, I like how big it is. I like how weird it is. I wished it was a little weirder. It is one of those movies where I think you get more urgency elementally by being a documentarian. Like things are just come out more urgently. Things, if like the things they do in that movie to create narrative and to create like fantasy are so striking because they break out of that urgency so quickly. But this one, since you are in a narrative world the whole time, like it doesn't strike you quite as much. Like the the filmmaking hasn't changed at all, really, to fit the narrative space. I just find him a much more stronger documentarian so far. Right. I would love to see what he does after this. There's a lot of interesting things going on here, and the script is very, very interesting. It's one of those movies where you might love it, you might hate it. I'm mostly in the middle. I think it's good. It shows a lot of promise. But I can't wait to hear the discussion for sure.
Interesting, man. I'll be checking it out. This is another Neon one. It's fucking interesting, man. They got some good buyers on that team. In The Act of Killing, to just say something about a Josh Oppenheimer film that I've seen already. I mean, boy, oh boy, folks, that's not something to watch on a cloudy day. I'll tell you that much.
No. You wait till you're in a very particular mood to get bummed out, because that one will really fuck you up. That one will put you in a very bad mood.
Zeb364 commenting on Luckiest Man in America says, sounds like another movie put in the bin labeled should have been a documentary or a documentary series. Yeah. Let's leave it at like maybe 100-minute documentary, 2 hours tops. These series things, we got to fucking stop it, folks.
It's quite a lot.
And I understand it's a business model and money, and I understand how it works. It doesn't mean I have to like it.
Nice.
But I think Zeb is right. And then they would have made the bad narrative after the fact.
There you go.
So we just got a couple more here. A director that I really like, but boy, sometimes he makes it hard. David Gordon Green's new one, Nutcrackers, which no distributor yet on this puppy, but that'll quickly change. Exorcist Believer is one of the worst movies I've ever seen in my life. Hands down.
Pretty awful.
But David Gordon Green is a great filmmaker who's made movies that I absolutely love. And I will say with Nutcrackers, while I didn't love it, it's nice to see him out of a big studio mold. I mean, those three Halloween films, which I think he had some movies in between, but then like Halloween into Exorcist Believer. And it was just like, what are we doing?
Yeah.
Thank the movie gods that fucking trilogy was canceled.
Please. Oh my God.
Or at least, shelved for retooling or whatever it is. He gets to make this very little movie, and not little as insignificant, little as it's just a smaller movie. With Ben Stiller, he plays a guy who loses his sister and brother-in-law in a car accident. And he has to go to the small farm town in Ohio where they live and take care of their four boys until a social service worker played by Linda Cardellini can find the kid's placement in a foster home or group home or whatever. Very small human story, much like on the level we met David Gordon Green at before Pineapple Express, and all that. So it was cool to see that sort of reset for him or a revisit, And Stiller's really great in the movie. The four boys are great. They're actually four real life brothers. And it's just it's a nice little movie. It's weird having to watch it, the week after Labor Day. It's a Christmas movie. Insofar as Nutcrackers, we are referring to the Nutcracker suite, and there's the sister was a ballet instructor, and she taught the boys ballet is like the thing at the end of the movie. It's not really a spoiler. It's in the fucking copy. But I will say the festival copy makes it sound like it's going to be a much more significant part of the film than it actually is. And I'm sitting there like, when are we going to address the fucking ballet elephant in the room? and they get there and it's fine. My beef with it is that, like, from the jump, you know exactly where it's going. Yeah. You know, I mean, from me explaining, you know, summarizing the plot, you can figure it out. And, you know, so when you have those kinds of movies, it's all about the journey to get there. And this was a pretty okay journey. It's Stiller definitely in, like, indie kind of more serious role. There's not like a "can you deal with that" like Ben Stiller moment in the movie. He doesn't Stiller out.
We call that bomb bocking when you decide to take it back a step. You just be a little bit more even keel. You know we're dealing with serious subject matter here. You don't do the hobbity gibbity or whatever the fuck, you know.
Yep. No, it's you're totally right. Ben is bomb backing in this movie. And he's good at it. And it's not like, you know, he's proven that time and again. But it's not like schmaltzy. I'm thinking about like Secret Life of Walter Mitty kind of Ben Stiller. Which that movie was nice and whatever.
It's fine.
You know, the schmaltz was tough.
Quite something.
The kids are all, you know, good, like they're clearly brothers, and that was very smart, or I should say possibly lucky, you know, that Gordon Green got the casting like that. Oh, yeah. You got a good now I'm gonna forget the fella's name. Let me see here. A Toby Huss in a supporting role.
I love Toby Huss.
What I wanted more of, I'll tell you right now, and because it's 104 minutes, so it's not terribly long, but more of loser town cop played by Tim Heidecker.
Nice. But I mean, anytime he shows up,
it's like three scenes though, and I'm like, man, let that guy cook. Where's that guy's movie? Like, maybe David Gordon Green can make other movies about stories from this town.
Sure.
And one of it's Tim Heidecker. It's just he's great. Love Heidecker. So no distribution on this sucker yet. It would be, you know,
weird not to pick this. I would assume some streamer is going to pick this up before Christmas time and make it, you know, like your here's our big Christmas movie. Hey, everybody, look, we got a Christmas movie now. And I mean, honestly, what Gordon Green, other than the Halloweens and the Exorcist movie, he's always been good at the lead performance is usually very good. That's true of Stronger. That's true of the Pacino movie, Manglehorn.
I forgot about Manglehorn.
True. I mean, like, even like Joe and Prince Avalanche, all those like he did after the big comedy boom of Your Highness and The Sitter and Pineapple Express. I like him in this mode because honestly the best thing I had seen, the best thing I could say about him is I thought he was really good in Bones and All before as of recent. I was like, he's nice in that. I would like to see more of him in that, but and I know that Luca likes having directors in his movies anyway. It has been other. I didn't particularly like the two other Halloween movies, and then Exorcism Believer is so fucking bad. It's not even fucking funny.
Makes them Halloween movies look like goddamn masterpieces. Beautiful. All the three. I have kind of come around on those other. Well, the last Halloween movie, the middle one, I'm still whatever. But yeah, as far as, you know, this is like all the real girls kind of territory. But yes, things like Prince Avalanche, Joe, which is the Cage movie.
Yes. Stronger is the one I always go to, the Boston bombing guy.
Gyllenhaal, right?
Yeah, as the guy who got really injured during the Boston bombing. It's really worth looking into if you haven't. That's one of his best, I think.
All right, so here we go. The last one of this broadcast, and again, we'll be coming back at you sometime Sunday night. So be sure you like and subscribe. Make sure you get the notifications. Click the bell. I see, you know, some people in the chat were like, hey, I saw the notification. I bopped in. Exactly right, y'all, because we're kind of flying by the seat of our pants, you know, because schedules adjust all the time and so on. So just notification bell, like and subscribe, all that good stuff. So here we go. It's the one that, like, hey, like drinking a Guinness in Ireland, we're in Canada. We had to see the new one from our man, David Cronenberg, The Shrouds. Hell yeah.
Yes.
How fucking yeah.
Yes, this is a great, great, great movie. I was really, really happy with this. I'm so
last covered on this episode, but first movie we saw
Yes.
Of the festival. So we kicked off TIFF with this. Sorry, I cut you off.
No, please. This was a tough one because it was between this, O Canada, and Presence, the new Soderbergh. So I'm glad that both of those now have distribution, so I don't have to worry about it. And I picked right. This is the one that doesn't have distribution still. I don't know how, but
I know.
Whatever.
I think Entertainment One has it in Canada, but nothing on the US side yet. And I'm like, hey, Neon, like, did you take a bath with Crimes of the Future, or did you already like blow your budget for the year? Cause like, you should have just been gobbling up these Davy Crones, man. Come on.
I mean, I know Vincent Cassell is not someone people want to talk about often. He's not the nicest or guy or the most lawful guy, but.
Is he a jerk?
There's stuff you can look into it. I'm sure some people in the chat know. I think he's great in this. Very, very obviously doing Cronenberg. The hair, the way he dresses, all that stuff.
Dude, I have to say, it's fucking weird how much Vincent Cassell is made up to look like David Cronenberg in this movie. It's very bizarre.
I mean, what we're talking about, like, it is very much a response to the death of his wife. It's very obviously that. Yeah. And it's about a guy who creates a system of a graveyard system of like interconnected wires that allow you to look at your loved one in the ground thanks to shrouds that they are put in, and you can just on your app or on the actual tombstone can look at the bodies. And then one night there is a toppling, a break-in, and a bunch of these, as you can see right there in the image, they're broken down. They're broken by someone. They don't know who did it. They don't know why they did it. And the mystery of that is really the core of the movie. Yeah. He works with, I was so surprised. I maybe misread this. The first time he worked with Guy Pearce, the weirdest damn thing. You would have thought that he'd been in 100 of these.
Guy Pearce working with Cronenberg?
Yeah. He just seems like the right guy for him. Like,
I guess he would have slipped in somewhere. Yeah, that is kind of surprising.
He plays a complete loser in this, and it's phenomenal.
Oh my God. Oh, dude. Just the fucking Kirk Van Houten-ness of it all.
Yeah. Oh, man.
He's a super... It's like if Kirk Van Houten was like a hacker instead of a cracker factory salesman or whatever. He's such a fucking loser. It's so funny. And I have to say, I was rewatching Alien Covenant recently, and he's in a little bit of that. I fucking love that guy, and I love that he's in movies that I like again, because a lot of those space jail era movies, and I think Eric likes so I don't want to slam it, but you know what I mean? Like, he was in movies that thought were sort of like below or beneath Guy Pearce in one way or another.
Weren't using him to his full potential. And like,
exactly.
That's true. I mean, a lot of actors have that burden on them. I mean, he does so much, though. He gets to get, I think, all the stuff. It's just that I'm not watching every Guy Pearce movie.
No,
that's
exactly. Yeah, no, I'm not complaining that he's not working. He's just like working too much in the wrong things, I feel, is the idea.
I mean, what we were talking about, like this being about, it's interesting to me that this is about the passing of a loved one. Schrader has his wife is going through something very terrible, and like they are in hospice care now. And O Canada is partially about that. And probably been like what, one or two, maybe 3 years. Wiseman, a couple, is also clearly a response to the passing of his wife. These movies to me are like very emotional and very easy to like, but this one, it's so weird the tone he hits. It's there's this, he still has that distance thing, so you don't like get hit by it. And like the first image, I think, is the most emotional image, and then he goes very detached for the rest of it. But like, you can tell that is like both a, as we were talking about before we got on here, it is a self-deception. It is echoing the self-deception that's happening in the movie in a way that like, you are okay after this, you probably are not. And the way he takes this mystery, and the way he is like ultimately not really interested in the mystery at the very end of it, like, is so speaks to his interest in what like life is about and death is about, and like the body. Like, I love Crimes of the Future so much, and like the ideas he's been having as an older man about the body and what's going to happen with it as a tool and as a relic of things.
Yeah.
It's really been stunning. And this, I think, continues a lot of the ideas that were in Crimes of the Future into a different, very different, but a very good movie.
Yeah. It's kind of interesting. A lot of people were bothered by what winds up being Cronenberg's, I don't want to say disinterest, but his not prioritizing the mystery for the sake of the movie. And it's kind of fascinating because, like, that sort of, I feel, is a nice one-to-one as far as, like, the audience and him, right? Like, he's making this movie for a particular reason that only he and maybe his children can understand, but really only he can understand. And we're going to it because it's a Cronenberg movie and we're used to seeing him, like, do all these things. And those things are there, but he's not as concerned about them. So when the movie, it's actually kind of really nice because I sort of take it as like he's sort of taking back the movie and being like, no, like, I know this is what you expect me to dive more into, but instead this is just kind of like my feelings on things right now and my well-being. And that's more important to me in this movie than maybe your curiosity about some mysteries that I'm setting up. And the thing that's cool too is, like, the mystery is engaging and it is, it's fascinating how it all plays out. And there's a thriller kind of feel to it, but you also for sure have the body horror elements to it. In the film, Diane Kruger is the wife who has died from cancer. And she also has a twin sister. So you got Diane Kruger there and then a third wave of Diane Kruger that I won't spoil. But, a lot of the body horror stuff here is like very much a, not a science fiction body horror, but indeed like the horror that the body goes through due to medical treatment and specifically cancer treatment in this case. And so you're seeing that unfold in this movie. So like, that's why it's very fascinating, right? Like, yeah, he's got the body horror stuff and all of that, but in this instance, all of that stuff is playing towards a larger, more personal goal for him. Yep. And I think that's just brilliant. I think it's just fucking great. And I'm glad that he's able to, like, use his filmmaking prowess and his art to work through what is, you know, probably one of, or if not the hardest challenge in his life right now.
Oh, I'm sure. I mean, and I also just love that the guy is still, I mean, I felt it after Crimes of the Future for sure, but like that he still has this imaginative engine that he has, like the fact they came up with the Shroud. I mean, the Shroud is such an insane idea to begin with, and he has so much fun unpacking it and like letting it like seep into the world of these characters. It's, I mean, it always gives me chills. I was happy to see it in his hometown. Honestly, it was real. It felt right for what might be, like, if not his last movie, one of his last movies to be here.
For sure.
Yeah.
I mean, you never know. I mean, the dude's 81 years old, so
he's up there.
You know, we'll see. But yeah, it's at the New York Film Festival again. I'm sure by the time this festival is over, you know, I've been sitting here like waiting for the deadline pop up to come up and say someone bought it. Someone's going to buy it. This isn't going to be some sort of like, you'll never see this movie. I just think it's unfortunate. Y'all fucking film buyers are taking so long. Snatch this shit up. It's great. but that's going to do it for this round one of two for our Toronto recaps. Chris, what is, just give folks a teaser of what's to come. What's one thing that we haven't seen yet that you're looking forward to?
Well, tomorrow I'm right in the morning. I have Anora, Sean Baker's big winner out of Cannes, and right into Mike Leigh's new one, Hard Truths, which is him reteaming with his, I'm forgetting her name, his act, the lead actress from Secrets and Lies.
I'm not
completely blank, but she's fantastic, and I'm looking at both those. The big one, though, and I really cannot wait for it, is Night Bitch. I am like dying to see Night Bitch. I really am looking forward to that.
Oh yeah, Night Bitch is kind of like the one I'm here for. That's the new one from Mariel Heller, who I saw. You know, Can You Ever Forgive Me? Did I see it? I don't think I saw it here, No, I didn't actually. It was at the festival, but it was right after, it was 21, so it was COVID stuff. I didn't see it here. I love that movie. I cannot wait for this movie. Did she also do
Beautiful Day in a Neighborhood?
Yes, she did. The Hanks, Mr.
Unbelievable,
Rogers.
Really, really wonderful film.
Yes.
So I'm very
surprisingly
excited.
Very
excited to see a darker side with this one. Those, like, Can You Forgive Me certainly has its darker elements, and so does Beautiful. This is like actually like a severe premise that is pretty dark.
Yeah. So I'm looking forward to that too. I'm looking forward to the Gia Coppola, The Last Showgirl. Yep. Pam Anderson plays a Vegas showgirl whose show closes after 30 years, and it's like, what do I do with my life? Can't wait to see what goes down with that. And then also, I'll say it just because I like watching everything he does, and who the heck knows, but the new Mike Flanagan is my first thing tomorrow morning, Life of Chuck.
Sure.
So we'll see about all that. But yeah, thanks for sticking around, folks. This was very cool. This will, of course, you know, tell your friends. The replay will be on YouTube, but we will also, of course, have this guy on the old podcast feed as well. I'm going to try to maybe turn that around tonight. I don't know. No promises, but it will be there too. But all right, dude, so we will tune back in Sunday night with some more picks. But all right, man, let's go back to the movies. I'll see you later.
All right, see you
later. Bye-bye.